Some important bits of housekeeping before we go straight to this podcast that was recorded at the Polish-Ukrainian border. A bit of self-promotion first. The Tortoise Shack Live is back on the Easter Bank Holiday weekend in the Sugar Club in Dublin. Tickets are available now on eventbrite.ie, so you can grab them there. Come along. I promise you it'll be another great night out. The last one was epic, and this promises to... It's already shaping up to be a fantastic evening of entertainment and infotainment, if I can be so cheesy. Please consider supporting this project. It's no ads, no sponsors. It's, you know, we don't want to be pulling punches. We don't want ads from AIB or Now TV or any of that drivel. So please keep us ad-free and editorially no interference by joining us on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's a couple of quid. It's the price of a fancy coffee once a month, and it really makes all the difference. Also, at the end in this podcast, there are some really good recommendations of organizations you can support if you want to help the people trying to flee Ukraine currently. One is the Halinnik Law Center, and I know I've butchered that, but they are offering legal support to people who are being evacuated from Ukraine. Subject to temporary protection status and to get them out of immigration detention and, you know, helping in that aspect. There's the Avalon Foundation, who's providing specialized support to evacuate refugees with disabilities. That's there as well. And then the Polish Humanitarian Action are issuing what Hannah McCarthy recommended, debit cards with funds in them, so refugees can have autonomy and dignity to be able to do the things that they want, where you're not sending, you know, packs of nappies or two brushes that no one needs. You're giving people the opportunity to do what they want to do. So there's the tree that are, the links are in the bio of this podcast. And if you are thinking you'd like to do something good for the people in Ukraine and the people who are trying to leave Ukraine, there's three recommendations. The links are there. I'll let you listen to this podcast. Thank you. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and we are continuing to cover events, tragic and heartbreaking events in Ukraine. But as part of that, we've covered it from all aspects of humanitarian issues, and we will continue to go back to people on the ground in Kyiv and in different parts of Ukraine. But there's a lot more going on in the response, and it's actually... I feel like I don't want to start on a down, so I won't. I am being joined by how do I put this? I feel like a friend of the pod now, because we had a chat, but it wasn't on the podcast previously, Teresa. But from the Immigrant Council of Ireland, the integration manager, Teresa Buczkowska. Teresa, you're currently in Poland and you've been to the border. First of all, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you for the invitation. That's right. I'm in Poland right now. I just finished a four-day trip to assess the situation on the ground, what's happening with refugees, and how we can best inform our responses in Ireland.
Yeah, and I think that is really, really crucial that you're first of all, you can bring your expertise to that and that you can then impart that, because I don't know if you saw today that already less than a month into this war, over 10,000 people have now arrived from Ukraine into Ireland, and we really do need to know what is the best way to deal with this. But before we go to that, can I just ask you just to shed a bit of light on your experiences the last few days and what you saw and how you feel what you feel the challenges are on that most difficult of journeys that people are making?
Definitely, it was an emotional roller coaster, because we've seen an amazing situations when you could see that the local authority has everything under control and they are organizing really great responses on the ground in Poland. But also we've seen local authorities who are not coping well, who don't really know how to manage the situation, because the problem is that we don't have our central government in Poland doesn't really coordinate responses, and we don't have one standard response. So it all depends on personal capacities of the different local authorities, how they are preparing and providing the support for refugees. But also that support that is being provided right now, this is short-term support. These centers, refugee centers, they are transit centers. The people only can stay there for 3, maybe 4 nights top, and they have to move somewhere else to make space for other people coming. Right now, everyone was saying that the time is quite quiet, that, really not that many people are coming, but everyone is preparing for the second wave because people are still traveling from Kharkiv, from Mariupol, from Kiev. And these people arriving now are much more vulnerable because, as it always happens, the first people who left were people with means, people who could afford the travel, who had options. And when they arrived in Poland, they could really support themselves and they had plans where to go. Now that cohort is very vulnerable. People don't have any plans. They don't know where to go. And the next wave that will come will be even in more desperate situation.
Now, I think you've hit on a critical point there about people who had the means to get out and had the means to actually, they could go to extended family or they could go to support networks. Many employers stepped up. I know employers that have offices across the EU that said that, if you're based in our Kyiv office now, you can base yourself in our office in Lisbon, for example, and it offered all of those supports, which is really great to see. But again, it means that the people who are, and a majority of Ukrainians are not flahuluk, as we'd say in Ireland, with lots of money and with the ability to do that. The other thing that strikes me, and I spoke to Hannah McCarthy when she was in Lviv about this, was, so for example, I think Lviv is, say, a city of 500,000 people, which then received in 250,000 people. And it's it's the equivalent of Cork sitting there and being told everybody from Galway, Kerry and Limerick are coming here and going to pass through every few days. So the logistics of this are very complex. Has the humanitarian effort, you can't just flick a switch and turn it on, but could you see the machinery coming to life and starting to process people in a more humane way, or was it still spluttering along?
So as I said, it all depends on local authority, because it all fell down on the back of local authority. So for example, in Przemyśl, we have a really amazing president of the city of Przemyśl. He is a former medical, he worked in a medical rescue team here in Ireland, actually. So he has experience dealing with emergency situations. So they organize that really well. They develop their own registration program for people, their own program, database for people offering transport, volunteers, and so on. So that really looks well organized. And when we went there, we kind of felt a sense of hope. And that model could be replicated in other places. Obviously, the big question for everyone right now is security and safety, especially of children, separated children. That was the focus on our trip. And as much, as well-organized Przemyśl is, they still have those issues there. But then we went to a different local authority, and that was total chaos. Anyone could come in, anyone could leave the reception center. There was no coordination. They were doing their best, and they were working really hard. We were talking to volunteers who were on 12-hour shifts, and they didn't even have time to drink a glass of water in that 12-hour. And so that response over there is really still developing. And I think there is an important role for central government coordinating those efforts and providing people with learning opportunities, how best to organize that. So if we have somebody doing a really great job, take those learning and implement that in other places.
Yeah, the copy and paste model is something that we should all be looking at. As listeners might have heard a previous conversation with Will Holden, who has who people know has been in Yemen, he's been in Syria, he's been in Iraq, and they not everything is the same, but there are central things that you can do to maintain supply chains, to maintain logistics support, and to try and keep humanitarian corridors moving. So yeah, there's all of those learnings and there is an expertise to it. Can I just, you mentioned children and separation, and I'm just conscious of this family separation is a really, really strong thing that people, like when people have got to the border, there's a relief, but there's also a devastation of the people who they left behind. Did you feel that any of those personal stories that people that they maybe they're not quite understanding what's happened yet, or they're dealing with it in the best way that they can?
Yeah, I think I might break even telling you about those stories, because they're not graphic. It's not about people being killed by bombs. It's about those emotional separation that people have to go through. These were the most heartbreaking stories. So there was one that we come across one example when there was a boy who was 15 years of age. His mother put him on a train to Poland on his own. And she stayed behind because they live in a small village. They have a farm with animals there. And she couldn't leave them without anyone because they lived on their own. They had nobody else there. Because if she left the animals would die, and there would be really nowhere to go back to, nothing to go back to. So she decided to stay, care for the animals, and she sent the child on his own to the border. There was another example where, here you go, here comes the tears.
It's okay.
I need to compose myself.
It's absolutely fine.
Yeah, so there was another example, a mother, she had one daughter, she was barely 18, and a son who was 12. She dropped them at the border. She brought them in and make sure that they were handed over to Polish authorities, and she went back to support her husband who was fighting.
Yeah. I know this is not the same when you see that, but I was on the phone with Lesia Vasilenko as she was driving away to bring her children to her mother and father-in-law to head back towards Kyiv. And I was on the phone and she was kind of talking matter-of-factly, and I just thought it was the saddest, heartbreaking thing. So I understand totally. And I think that there's something admirable in that strength, but it's also devastating when you see family separation at that level. So, look, I appreciate you sharing that. But if I can move on and just sort of talk about the numbers of people who are now displaced, it's said to be in excess of 10 million people now who have been displaced. It's like Ukraine is a country of 40 million people. So that's a quarter of the population who have at least been moved along. The numbers that we've seen, even in Ireland, have been far above what was, assessed in the early days. We said, oh, we'll see a few thousand, and now we're at 10,000. The pledges of people have been, really the human reaction has been really encouraging. But you deal with the reality of that in the Immigrant Council. You know what integration means, what getting people supports means, what resources, and unfortunately, what dealing with trauma is going to be like as well at the end of this. What, if I was to ask you now, what is your feeling now in terms of our, and I don't mean just Irish capacity, but the EU's capacity to deal with think of those numbers, 10 million people displaced. It does seem to be a challenge that requires huge resources pumped into it now.
Yes, absolutely. Lots of Ukrainian people still didn't really make the decision to cross the border because they are desperate to stay in Ukraine. They think this is going to be over in a couple of weeks and they will be able to go back. So we've seen a lot of people staying behind the border just in case they will be able to go back home. So that will be another wave of people coming into Poland and other European countries like Slovakia and Moldova as well. They are not in EU, but they are an European country. And those border countries, they are already overwhelmed. The population of Warsaw grew by 17% in the last 4 weeks.
Wow.
So that's nearly, a fifth of the city just suddenly grew within not even 4 weeks. And we need long-term planning program for a long-term relocation. And yes, funding will be needed to provide people with proper accommodation, because as much as honorable those pledges from individual people are, they are not long-term solutions, especially if people are only offering a bedroom. Because people might, you know, after 3 months, they say, like, I want my life back. And that's normal. That's obviously, we are trying to help as much as we want in this situation. But long-term, people will not be able to do that. That's also impact on their mental health. My friend in Poland, she offered a spare bedroom to a mother with two children, but she didn't realize how heavy it would be on her emotional state dealing with somebody who's traumatized. And eventually the woman decided to move to a different country. So she was, my friend was relieved, saying, like, I didn't know if I would be able to continue with that arrangements. And she didn't even know that that's going to happen. And I'm sure that will happen as well in Ireland. So long-term resettlement program is needed with proper resources, but we also need to prepare it in advance. We cannot rush it, especially when it comes to separated children, because the legal aspect of that has to be fixed before children are being moved from one country to another. Legal guardianship needs to be sorted out. And that's something that we've learned, that right now it's a huge chaos and a huge mess. And there is a place for the European Union to set up procedures and also standard procedures for legal guardianship over children. So if somebody is moving to Poland, from Poland to Germany, but then they decide to go to France, the same will procedure we apply, and they don't have to reapply it all over again. And that will provide some security for the children. And that's only one of the examples how European Union can act collectively outside of securing the physical aspects of integration, like access to labor market, access to education, housing, and so on.
I think, but isn't it great in one way that the way you've just outlined very quickly there what a template for successful integration would look like, given our own problems with, you know, the struggle that has been the campaign to end direct provision, and you think of how, you know, we can do this. I mean, I'm going to be talking to Lorcan Sir this week as well, the housing professor, and he has some interesting things to say on the government using emergency powers to free up vacant buildings and the like. So, you know, all of those things that we were told 30 days ago were impossible are now possible, which is you know, I don't mean to sound, but we need to try and take the positive out of this awful situation and see how we can do things better.
Absolutely. That's what I've been talking all time long since this crisis started. I see a lot of resentment within migrant and refugee communities, both in Poland and in Ireland. Like, why, you know, Ukrainians, they are getting everything and we don't get anything, and we have to go through this long process. But I would really switch that other way and start talking about welcoming refugee policies are possible, and they are easy to do. We've seen that being done across all Europe, including Ireland. So we need to expand those welcoming refugee policies to include everyone. And let's use that opportunity to do that. We, like, you know, we cannot take a step back anymore from what's been done for the Ukrainians. We just need to pull everyone with us to the same point. So every crisis brings an opportunity, and that is an opportunity for us within the migration sector. We can advocate now, well, you've done amazing job with welcoming refugee policies for Ukrainians. Let's do it now for everyone.
Yeah, I think the phrase we like to say is no going back, and let's not accept that we have to go back to a two-tier system. The one issue though that is that I do think you touch upon when you talk about integration, and I know it's something that you've worked diligently yourself personally on, and I know it's something that you work actively on right now about your amplifying migrants' voices, amplifying that experience, and actually, you know, integration into communities. Is there things that you think, outside of, you know, volunteering a room, is there things that Irish people should be thinking about in terms of their communities, in terms of that local civic engagement when people are being brought into the communities, and not just for Ukrainians, but for all people who enter our local community?
Oh, that's a complex question. I think that we need to stop seeing migrants and refugees as helpless people in need of charity, because we need equality, not charity. And equality isn't about doing something for us. It's about providing equal platforms so we can do it for ourselves, because we want to do it for ourselves. And one of those elements is about making space for us in terms of voting for migrant candidates in local elections, but also bringing people onto school boards and other decision-making bodies that can bring that migrant voice into the decision-making processes. But also kind of, again, switching that mindset, thinking like, I need to help you. Actually, you don't need to help me. You actually just need to make room for me so I can help myself.
Yeah, I see. This is why it's important to have these conversations, because there's far too much of this. We do like to do. I think it was Peter McVeary referred to it as we like to send the check. We like to pay a few quid, but it means to actually changing or sharing the experience, we're a little less comfortable with that. And that goes not just for the migrant experience, but for class issues and people with addiction issues and people in trauma. So one last thing in terms of the idea, and I know this might be a bit unfair of me to ask you, but I keep coming back to this. We're asking people to take people in, to house them, to shelter them. I don't think we have the resources to do enough sort of vetting of a lot of this currently. I don't think we have enough resources to you know, like, and this is going to sound really callous to me, Teresa, so tell me I'm a dickhead if you want. But I have three kittens and a dog, and I've adopted them all from shelters. And when I do an adoption, they do a house inspection and they make sure that, you know, I worry that we don't have the resources to do these things correctly for people who are coming in, who have already possibly suffered family separation trauma and whatever other traumas they have. It worries me.
It is very worrying. Obviously, most of people are doing this out of goodwill, but we have to remember that when there is a crisis situation, there will be always predatory behavior. And that's already happened in many European countries because there is that huge need for support. People are willing to cut corners when it comes to security issues and safety issues. And that is very, very worrying, especially about when it comes to women and children. I witnessed that myself in one of the reception centers in Poland, when I overheard two coordinators of the center arguing whether they should to do a detailed check of people's papers, of people who are transporting refugees to other centers, or they should just let them to do it, so because it will be faster and that way we will help more people. We cannot cut corners here, because there will be situations and that people will be, they are already vulnerable, so they will be traumatized. So absolutely, we have to vet it. If it takes longer, well, that's the cost. That's the mitigating factor to making sure that we do not cause more additional trauma to people.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point, because it's not anecdotal. I've seen reports from people on the ground about predatory behavior. We've seen reports in Ireland about people offering accommodation for sex. And we've seen reports of human trafficking groups seeing this as an opportunity as well. We need to be much more, and it's not about saying anybody who's doing things altruistically to help people is a bad person. We're not, no one is saying that. We just want, as Teresa is outlined there, we need to take those extra few steps to make sure that people aren't put into more difficult situations, and we can push back against that. Teresa, if people did want the help, I very much of the mindset that stop sending stuff and start sending cash. I know Hannah McCarthy recommended people should be given almost debit cards with cash loaded up into them to get them started as a thing. What would you say would be the way to give someone a start? It's certainly not sending a pair of stilettos, as I saw famously someone did.
Yeah, the reception centers in Poland are overwhelmed with donations because they are keep flowing from all over Europe. And this basically, they look like a loading area of Lidl or Aldi, because the trucks are keep coming and are offloaded. And then they select whatever they need in that center, and then they send it further into Ukraine because they don't need it. And you can find there anything from mattresses to wheelchairs to stilettos to nappies to toys, anything you want. And definitely that's not needed. And I would say, yes, send cash, but don't necessarily send it to the big organizations like the Red Cross or UNHCR, because do your research, who's actually doing a really great job. So we've met this Polish organization, Polish Humanitarian Action, which I'm actually promoting on my social media when it comes to donations. They're going to give debit cards to refugees in Poland with cash so they can start their own life, and they can really have agency to decide what they want to do with their life. They don't have to wait for that charity. And that is giving people dignity. And that is very important part of supporting refugees, so they can feel like normal human being. I can decide if I want to buy myself an apple. I don't have to go and ask somebody to give me the apple, or if I want to buy myself a pair of stiletto instead of waiting for some stilettos from Ireland to arrive. So do your research. Choose those smaller organizations. I'm gonna share information.
We'll put this on. We'll absolutely put this. I won't be asking you folks for a Patreon subscription today. I'll be asking you to support these people that Teresa is saying are doing the work on the ground. Absolutely critical. Last thing is the last 4 days. For you personally, I can see it in you. It's taken a toll. Do you think that before we came on air, we kind of discussed briefly that the idea that this is going to be a prolonged conflict, and that does seem to be the case. Do you feel that this might be something that in the months to come, not the days to come, that we're still trying to all of this goodwill, you worry that the goodwill goes away and that it becomes the mundanity of war?
Yeah, I think that might happen. I think people for their own mental health might start ignoring what's happening, and it will become just another conflict that is happening. And definitely, if there is a risk of us just getting used to it. And there is a danger because everything that's happening right now is so heavily based on volunteers and goodwill of people without proper support from the government, any government in the European Union, that might collapse. Because if volunteers will not arrive at those reception centers in Poland, they will not be run because there's no paid staff who's doing that work. And the same might happen in Ireland. If we don't have pledges of accommodation, where people will go? We need to start planning now for what is going to happen in the next couple of months. Because if we don't start planning now, when that goodwill will run out, that's too late to start planning.
Teresa Butchkowska, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. I hope you come back to Ireland nice and safely and get a little bit of rest, because I know it's been a difficult few days. We'll have the links in this, folks, for the recommended charities that Teresa says we should all reach out to. Please do. You know, that's the way to do it. And I think the crucial issue there is the dignity part. It's that part of giving that person that idea of having control over themselves. You're not handing them a sandwich that you made. They get to go and choose what they want on their sandwich, and it's as simple as that. And I tell you, the lesson loud and clear is that we have lots to do, lots to learn, and we can't afford to look away now. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for the work that you and your colleagues at the Immigration Council do. It is really appreciated.
Thank you.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.